From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. How many of us have not enjoyed soap operas on radio and television, whether openly or secretly? Why do soap operas provoke violent attack and zealous defense? In addition to their contribution to the economics of American broadcasting, what cultural and aesthetic ends do soap operas serve? With some answers and insights into those questions, Soundings now presents a conversation with the author of a new book about one of America's television pastimes. The book is Speaking of Soap Operas, recently published by the University of North Carolina Press. The author is Robert Allen, a professor of radio, television, and motion pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Robert Allen, soap operas account for $1 billion a year in television advertising revenue. They attract an estimated 50 million viewers daily, most of them women between the ages of 18 and 50. One early critic called soap operas serialized drool, and yet they embody an important cultural and economic continuation of what literary critics call women's fiction, dating back to the 19th century. For modern audiences, soap operas represent social models, both good and bad, as well as entertainment, and they've become the subject of critical inquiry and mass communications research. Robert Allen, you are the author of Speaking of Soap Operas. Let me begin by putting you just a bit on the defensive and being a little bit impertinent. Why in the world would a serious academic write a book about soap operas?
Well, it's not the first time I've been asked that, Wayne. Obviously, my students ask me a good deal. The reason that I got interested to begin with in researching soap operas and eventually writing a book about soap operas was what I found to be a very curious paradox. The paradox was that the more you begin to look at the history of broadcasting and the success of various forms of broadcast programming, the more you come to the conclusion that if you had to pick one genre of radio and television programming that has been the most successful, if you had one program to put in the time capsule so that 100 years from now people will say, what was American broadcasting like between 1930, let's say, and 1985? It wouldn't be a news program. It wouldn't be a situation comedy. It wouldn't be a variety show. It wouldn't even be a prime time show.
It would be a soap opera.
It would be a soap opera.
Well, Bobby Allen, does that mean that you are an apologist for soap operas? I take it that you're doing some rigorous analysis here.
Apologist in the sense of attempting to explicate something and put forward a point of view. In that sense of apologist, yes. In the sense of apologist, if you mean trying to defend soap operas from all comers and trying to raise them to some new stature as art form or marvelous panacea for society's problems, no, not at all. Let me get to the other half of this paradox that I was talking about,
Okay.
because I think it provides the real impetus is the two sides of the same coin.
Fair enough.
One side is soap opera's incredible longevity, their incredible success.
When did they originate, just parenthetically?
In the early 1930s. Painted Dreams is the soap opera that I've been able to discover, and I'm not the first, as being the first soap opera, the first daytime serial drama directed toward women that was broadcast on a radio station that we know anything about. And it came out of Chicago and was written by a woman named Erna Phillips. So we've had soap operas around since about 1930. They have been probably the most successful advertising vehicle that broadcasters have ever come up with. They reach the prime consuming group in the American population. That is women between the ages of 18 and 35 and then 49 if you really want to extend that group a little bit further. Their success has been countered by the fact that it's difficult to imagine, with the possible exception of pornography, a form of cultural production that's been any more disdained than has the soap opera.
Oh, Bobby Allen, it's fun to look down your nose at soap operas.
Well, it's to the point that if you want to criticize a play or a film,
you compare it.
You don't compare it. You call it a soap opera. This is nothing more than a soap opera.
Right.
I mean, the term has come to take on such a strong connotation of that which is not worth viewing, listening to, writing about, studying, that we can use the term to denigrate something else. And by the very fact that we call something a soap opera, we have placed it in the category of things which by their very definition are not art, are not worthy of our attention.
Do you, Robert Allen, you've written a book called Speaking of Soap Operas, do you see, you've just described the paradox of soap operas, do you see them in any sense as a form of art? What elements are there that would engage, the high-minded?
Well, I try to do two things in the book with regard to the question, are soap operas art or not? One is to examine why it is that traditional aesthetic theory and criticism has been unable to come to terms with soap operas for the last 50 years or so. And I think the reason is that the soap opera presents such a challenge to most traditional theories of what is art that there's really nothing that the traditional critic can say about the soap opera. Let me give you an example. We presume if you're writing a review of a play or a film or a novel that you can identify what that thing that you're criticizing is.
You can give it a category, a label.
Well, not only can you give it a category, but you can define it as being separate from everything that it is not. I mean, you know that The Sound and the Fury begins on page 1 and it ends on page 357, and every time you pick up The Sound and the Fury, it's going to be, in some sense at least, the same object. If you're looking at a painting, that painting has a border around it. It has limits. It's cut off. And so you can stand outside of it and contemplate it and say something about it.
It is not a well-wrought urn. It is not something that is fixed there for us to come back to time and again.
That's the problem with the soap opera, because the soap opera is the only narrative form that I know of, with the possible exception of comic strips, that are predicated upon the impossibility of their own closure, their own ending. One of the problems in traditional mass communication research that's been done on soap operas is the tendency to lump everyone who watches soap operas into the same general category, and then to make some rather assumptions about that category, namely that they're mindless housewives sitting around in their hair curlers eating bonbons and watching this mindless entertainment. If we begin to probe that notion of the single soap opera audience just a little bit, common sense will tell us that the monolithic nature of it falls apart very quickly. For example, if we go a few miles from here to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and go in the College Union at 3 o'clock this afternoon, you will see on the big screen TV General Hospital being displayed, and you'll see 40, 50 college students watching that program. Now, if you drive just down the street a little bit to Carrboro and knock on a door there, you will probably have it opened by someone who is at home watching that same program. And yet, do we want to say that the social functions being served are the same for both of those sub-audience groups? And I think common sense, and in fact research, will bear out that that's not the case. College students, for example, watch soap operas because it's a break in their routine. It's an excuse to get together with friends. It's a nice, pleasant, and risk-free way of meeting people. It's a way of being initiated, in a sense, into a social club, and the club dues are paid by your attendance at soap opera screenings and getting to know how to read a soap opera. For the person who's at home taking care of children, working at home, then of course the social functions are very different. If we look at the audience group that's over 55, 65 years old, we may find that soap operas serve yet other social functions by giving a vicarious sort of social relationship with a fictional community behind the screen that in some sense helps to compensate perhaps for lack of social interaction in that person's own life. And of course, when we talk about male white academics who are studying soap operas, then we're talking about social functions that are different yet again. The point is that in trying to say, do soap operas do this? Do they teach us that? Do they have this effect? Do they have that effect? That question always begs another question. Upon whom? In what circumstances? Over what period of time? And it's again, opening up the complexities of this whole phenomenon. And it's a massive phenomenon. It's estimated that 2/3 of all American women living in homes with television sets
watch soap operas. Your book is Speaking of Soap Operas, Robert Allen. Let me ask you to talk about the soap operas themselves. What do we find in them that entertains us, that engages us?
Well, in one sense, they are closer to the experiential world of the viewer than most other forms of dramatic television programming. For example, most of us don't have a talking car. Okay? Most of us don't have a brother or a cousin who is a private investigator in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't have cousins and nephews and uncles and aunts who drive around in vans working for the CIA or whomever, solving crimes as does the A-team. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Right.
Those are types of programs that are distanced from the experiential world of the viewer. And it is that difference that attracts the attention of the viewer. The viewer watches the program because they want to see someone who is not like themselves doing things that perhaps they wish they could, but ultimately are glad that they don't have to subject themselves to.
But by contrast, soap operas...
Soap operas do resemble the experiential world of the viewer in ways that most dramatic programming does not. Mm-hmm. A couple of examples. Most of us do have family relationships, romantic relationships, interpersonal relationships, social relationships that we have to endure or that we enjoy every day of our lives. And it is those relationships that form the very stuff of soap operas. Mm-hmm. Soap opera time comes a lot closer to experiential time than do the temporal dimensions of other types of television dramatic programming. At the beginning of an Isle of Lucy episode, Lucy is going to forget that Xavier Cugat's coming to dinner, and next week she will never have remembered that he came to dinner. On soap operas, the characters that constitute the soap opera communities have memories. Mm-hmm. Their experience of time is that which stretches over weeks and months and years and indeed even decades.
In that sense, soap operas are, what would you call them, self-reflexive. They kind of feed on themselves, whereas a program such as the one you mentioned, an episode from I Love Lucy, exists. It's existential. It's there and it's gone. We can see it in reruns, but that's us bringing a memory to it rather than the characters themselves.
Exactly right. And television's catching on. I mean, Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere's and Dynasty and Dallas and all of those have taken the serial form, which has been the characteristic form of soap opera since the early 1930s, and they've realized that by building in what I think you quite accurately describe as a certain self-reflexivity, a certain self-awareness of the network of characters and the fact that by endowing them with memories and histories, by endowing these characters with histories and memories, you make enormously more complex the narrative and you increase the possibilities for narrative pleasure.
Robert Allen, you are the author of Speaking of Soap Operas. Let me take you back to a point that you raised earlier in our conversation. How did all of this happen? That's a big order. Soap operas weren't simply invented by one man or woman. They obviously evolved over a period of time. Trace for me some high points, some important points in the history of soap operas, so that we can have a sense of soap operas then, soap operas now.
The soap opera is a result of the need of broadcasters and advertisers to do something with the empty hours in the broadcasting day.
Oh, gee, I'm disappointed.
Between 6 in the morning and 6 in the afternoon.
You're not going to talk about high art and
Not at all. I mean, when we're talking about soap operas, we cannot afford to forget that what we're talking about is a commodity. We're talking about something that came about for a definite reason, not because of a flash of inspiration from the muses, not because Erna Phillips was so much more prescient than anybody else who was living in America in 1930, but because broadcasters had a problem. What do you do between 6 in the morning and 6 in the afternoon to keep something on the air initially so people buy radio sets, but then after the early 1920s so that people would continue to, so that you could use that commodity that you had as a broadcaster, the airwaves to make money for your station.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, prime time programming on network radio was the thing that got the most attention to begin with, because that was when it was presumed people were at home with hours to spend listening to radio. Daytime television was this vast, unknown wasteland. No one knew who was listening.
Some will say it still is.
Yes, they would, for other reasons. But no one knew who was listening, except that there was a pretty good guess that people who were listening were not male. They were predominantly female.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone began to think, well, you know, it is, after all, those women who are at home looking after children, taking care of the house, working at home, whatever, who are buying Tide detergent and Crisco shortening, not only for themselves, but for their husband,
right,
for their children, and perhaps for members of a larger extended family. Perhaps by trading raw audience numbers for a quality of audience, quality in advertising terms,
mm-hmm,
that we may just have something here that's indeed just as important as primetime programming. Then the question becomes, how do you get that audience? How do you attract women listeners? And a number of different genres were attempted. The inspirational program, in which someone would read kind of lines of poetry and play soothing songs and tell inspirational anecdotes. The cooking show.
Uh-huh.
Recipe shows. What are you going to do for dinner tonight? Well, right, it came as no surprise to the listener that the answer to that question involved Pillsbury flour and Crisco shortening and whatever, and it was a natural for the advertiser to work a product into a program in such a way that the end of the program provided the payoff for the
sure,
audience member. One show that was extremely important in helping to establish the soap opera in a curious kind of way was Amos and Andy.
Hmm.
Amos and Andy came on the air in the late 1920s. It was not on during daytime. It was on at nighttime and primetime. It did not appeal primarily to a group of women listeners exclusively.
I never thought of it as a soap opera.
It was not a soap opera in the sense that I would use the term. It was a serial drama.
Mm-hmm.
It demonstrated that people would trade satisfaction based upon the end of a story,
mm-hmm,
for a continuing relationship with a set group of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stories in Amos and Andy didn't end with each episode. Situations were carried over from episode to episode in some cases. And the success of Amos and Andy, and the success was so great that the story is told that you could walk down the street of major cities when Amos and Andy was on, and you could listen to it by not having a radio set because it would be playing in every house that you walked past.
The advertiser's dream.
It was,
mm-hmm,
indeed. Pepsodent toothpaste. Ipana toothpaste, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of the toothpaste companies. An advertiser's dream. Well, when you put all of these various forces together, that is, you have an existing model of serial drama provided by Amos and Andy that was extremely successful. You have models of the cooking show, the advice show, the inspirational show, and the self-contained dramatic program. You put all those together with a need on the part of advertisers to reach the heavy consuming audience, women,
mm-hmm,
on the need on the part of broadcasters to get something that's fairly inexpensive to plug into those daytime hours.
Yeah.
You put all those things together and you have the makings for what eventually evolved as the soap opera. And the evolution came very, very quickly.
Hmm.
I mean, the notion that you could reach a female audience by giving that audience member situations that she resembled, concerns that spoke to her, family, home, relationships, bringing up children, dealing with parents, dealing with friends. When you put that together in a serial form, which gave her a reason to come back every single day for 15 minutes, 5 days a week,
mm-hmm,
then you had something that spoke to the concerns of that audience, got that audience very, very quickly,
mm-hmm,
and you had something that met the needs of advertisers and broadcasters.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about soap operas, television, and popular culture, the second in a series of conversations. My guest is Robert Allen, a professor of radio, television, and motion pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen is the author of Speaking of Soap Operas, recently published by the University of North Carolina Press. Here is Robert Allen.
I think what we find in soap operas is a sort of arena of values.
Not a single value. Okay.
And in fact, one of the things that's kept soap operas on the air as long as possible is that their values change.
Hmm.
For example, in the late 1940s, Procter & Gamble had an explicit proscription against depicting a divorce that had a happy ending. You could not have a character who was divorced who was portrayed in an attractive, positive kind of way.
How times have changed.
Exactly. Every soap opera character over the age of 12 has been divorced at least three times, as we all know. Some of those values do change as the population changes, as social mores change. Soap operas have dealt with abortion and incest and homosexuality and the Vietnam War and draft dodgers and every kind of social issue that has any currency at any given time has found its way into soap opera sooner or later, and usually before it's found its way into television drama on prime time. But let me get back to the point I was making about there being an arena of values in soap operas. Each soap opera seems to me to constitute a sort of central protected territory of values. And those values are what the producers of the show, what the sponsors and what the broadcasters believe their primary viewing audience will tolerate.
All right, now name a couple of these for me, these values in this arena that you were talking about. Marital stability?
Stability, the integrity of the family, child rearing in such a way that provides a supportive and nurturing atmosphere or environment in which the child to grow up, certain clear violations of normative codes of behavior will eventually be punished, even if it takes years and years and years to find the perpetrator, that good acts will, good in the way that we in Judeo-Christian communities would define good acts, will eventually be rewarded, and in a sense that the social and ultimately political status quo is okay. There's nothing wrong with it that a little bit of tinkering can't solve, and that usually the problems are personal problems. They're emotional problems. They're interpersonal problems. Soap operas don't deal with politics, except on a very personal level. The point that I make in the book is that soap operas are both commodities and they are commodifiers. That means that they turn their audience members into commodities.
Right.
The business of commercial broadcasting is not selling products to people. It's selling people to advertisers. And in enjoying soap operas and in deriving pleasure from soap operas, we have to keep in mind as scholars that in doing so, the price that we pay is being turned into the object of propaganda, advertising propaganda, in which we are trying to be persuaded to buy this product or that product. And that's something that goes hand in hand with the pleasure that we derive, not only from soap operas, but from any form of American commercial television. I think what we have misrecognized is that in the 1920s, when the United States government, through Herbert Hoover, who was then Secretary of Commerce, and others, decided that the public airwaves were to be used for the purpose of certain individuals and corporations generating profits through the sale of advertising. Once that decision was made, the fate of American broadcasting had been sealed. And that's the system that we have. And to rail against it as being insidious is, I think, to miss the point that from the early 1920s, it has been the case that the purpose, when you scrape away all the rhetoric, the purpose of American broadcasting, commercial broadcasting, is selling people to advertisers.
Sure.
Now, within that structure, we need to look at what has been the relationship between real people who have watched and listened to programs within this context, not only from the point of view of what effects that might have had upon them, but what choices they had available to them to make, and to what uses they put that material. And one of the things that I would argue in the soap opera book is that even if women have found soap operas silly, stupid, ridiculous, unrealistic at times, at least soap operas have spoken to their concerns. However modulated that voice of the soap operas has been, however ambiguous the relationship between the viewer, however ambivalent the relationship of the viewer to the soap opera, at least the woman has known that these are concerns that are, for the most part, hers. And they are not the concerns of Magnum P.I.
Right.
And the A-Team,
right,
and other primetime dramatic programming. Mm-hmm. And so I think instead of coming to easy answers of saying, are they valuable or not valuable? Are they good or are they bad? We need to ask for whom, under what circumstances.
Sure.
And the answer that we come up with is very often not one of instant assent or objection,
right,
but one of trying to understand a complex situation that exists within a particular structure.
Mm-hmm.
One final thing before I get off this. Just because we recognize that the system of American broadcasting is set up the way that it is, doesn't mean we have to accept it. It doesn't mean that we have to throw up our hands and say, it's like it is. All we can do now is to kind of tinker around the edges and see if we can't come up with more Hill Street Blues rather than more A-teams.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that if we're going to approach the system of American broadcasting, we have to do so with a knowledge of how that system came to be,
mm-hmm,
and the vested interest that exists to assure that it will probably stay in place regardless of the tinkering that we do around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
The basic structural factors are not going to change.
Well, let me ask you, Robert Allen, we're a bit off the topic here. Your book is Speaking of Soap Operas. What needs to be done? How, for example, if you had a magic wand, what changes would you make? And I guess you would address not only the issue of soap operas here, but as you say, the nature of broadcasting. How might it change beneficially?
In any number of ways. I think one of the ways that it could change, but again it would require a complete structural reformation of American broadcasting, is to expand the number of voices that get heard.
Mm-hmm. Access.
Access, and the range of uses to which broadcasting is put.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that could be changed is, and this is something I think that teachers and parents can do, is to bring young people to a greater understanding of what's going on whenever they sit down in front of a television set or in front of a movie screen or in front of a record player or a radio, exactly what the nature of that relationship, aesthetic, economic,
mm-hmm,
and social.
We don't examine these things.
We sure don't. We teach,
yeah,
our kids how to read from the time they get to school, even before they start school, until the time that they get out of college. So
but
that's 16 years, yeah, or more of how do you read a book.
But
how do you read
a
television show?
Yeah, you use
Where's
the TV as that? A babysitter.
A babysitter and an educator and a pacifier and,
yeah,
all sorts of different things.
Without examining necessarily the assumptions behind what the kids are absorbing.
Exactly.
Yeah. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second in a series of discussions about film, literature, television, and popular culture. My guest was Robert Allen, a professor of radio, television, and motion pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen is the author of Speaking of Soap Operas, recently published by the University of North Carolina Press. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Soap Operas and Popular Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, two conversations about the theme of beginnings in early American society. My guests will be William Rorabaugh of the University of Washington and Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Our respective topics will be apprenticeship in 18th and 19th century American culture and the beginnings of the practice of chemistry in the United States. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the second in a series of conversations about film, literature, television, and popular culture. My guest is Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina. Robert Allen is the author of a new book entitled Speaking of Soap Operas. In addition to their contribution to the economic basis of American broadcasting, what cultural and aesthetic ends do soap operas serve? Why do they provoke violent attack and zealous defense? Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.